Welcome to The Point. I'm Mindy Todd. Today, it's gardening with horticulturist and entomologist Roberta Clark. Morning, Roberta.
Good morning, Mindy.
866-999-4626 is our number for your garden questions this morning. That's 866-999-4626. Our email address is thepoint@capeandislands.org. All right, Roberta, what is it they say about New England? Wait a minute, it'll change.
Exactly. We need the rain.
Yeah, well, the cool, because I think people will go, wait, it's cold.
I am wearing a fleece vest right
now. I wore a jacket to work this morning. I know. So, and I think some people are a little bit worried because, you know, when we have that beautiful weather, sometimes we get ahead of ourselves and put things out that maybe we shouldn't. But for most, you know, Dan was saying, over the weekend, we planted 21 tomatoes. Are they going to be okay? They're going to be okay.
They will be okay. I'm known for pushing the envelope on certain things, and I actually planted my tomatoes, peppers, and cucumbers a week ago yesterday. and, of course, it was a lovely week, and they're doing just fine. And I anticipate that they'll come through the next several evenings when it goes down into the upper 40s just fine.
Yeah.
I'm more concerned about the 50 to 60-mile-an-hour winds forecast Thursday.
Yeah, I know Thursday's going to be rough. And I think because we've had a little bit of recent rain, I think some are surprised to see water restrictions in towns across our listening area. But we are still considered in a drought, right?
We are. A very interesting website that people certainly should check is the U.S. Drought Monitor. You can just put that into Google, and then they give you the option of going to your state. And it's updated every Thursday. And we have actually been in a drought since last summer. And I know people will say, well, geez, it's really rained a lot this spring. Well, if you look at what has been accumulated, it's actually very little. Mm-hmm. Yes, we have had a couple of storms where we've gotten a lot of rain. I recorded 1.7 inches in my rain gauge a couple of weeks ago. But for the most part, most of the rain events we've had, we might get a tenth of an inch, maybe a quarter if we're lucky, but it's generally not adequate for irrigating the ground and building up soil moisture. So we are considered, if you look at the drought map, it's been alleviated to a certain extent off Cape. Certainly Western Massachusetts is no longer included in the drought area. And off Cape, most of the state, the eastern part of the state, is considered dry. But parts of the North Shore and Cape Cod are still listed as having a moderate drought. So that's why many of the towns have somewhat early instituted water restriction.
Yeah, and we'll see what happens. See how much rain we get over this next storm on Thursday and after. You know, it's funny because I was wondering, I planted a redbud flamethrower in my side yard in the fall.
Great tree.
It was beautiful, but it is, I'm like, uh-oh, my other redbud's budding. What's happening here? I think it just, I don't know what happened. Maybe it didn't get enough water, but it is dead.
You planted it last year?
I planted it in September.
Yeah, which was particularly dry.
Yeah, and I watered it, but maybe not enough. But so I'm bumming about that. But I can't, I mean, that's like the only one recently that I've planted in recent years that I've lost. So I guess I can't complain too much.
Yeah. It's, you know, when you're planting things, often if we're in a dry spell, they need more water than we think they do.
Mm-hmm.
You have to really consider that the root system of trees and shrubs and even perennials and, hey, even six-packs of annuals, the root system is pretty tiny compared to the upper part of the plant, and it's unable to adequately provide the plant with enough moisture until its root system grows out. So newly planted things frequently require more water than we think. Well-established plants require a little bit less.
Yeah. All right, Catherine's already sent an email to us. She says, I have a climbing hydrangea that I've had for over 30 years. It's only ever had one blossom. However, the vines cover a large part of a very tall oak. I've never had any condition problems with it. Very recently, some sections of it seem to be dying. The leaves turned a light brown and curled up. I don't know what the issue is. I've invested years in this vine, and I don't harbor ill will towards for giving me only one blossom. I just hate to lose it. Any idea what
yes,
might be happening?
That's something to think about. I would, again, look at how it's maybe been watered, although if it's been in the ground that long, it should be doing well. Could be a question of shade. Mm-hmm. While they grow well in the shade, they do require some sun, and if it's a real full canopy oak, it just may be getting too much shade.
Yeah. I have two. One is going up an oak that does get a lot of sun. The other's back behind a couple of holly trees. And I planted the one behind the holly trees first. And it does fine. Doesn't have as many flowers. But it has not grown as far up into the tree that it's climbing up. But the one on the oak tree is just fabulous.
Yes,
and when it's in
gorgeous bloom,
oh my gosh. And I actually, I mean, you might remember years ago, there was a Master Gardener's tour that took place across the whole Cape. And I can't remember whose garden it was, but I walked into his yard and he had two of them climbing up these trees that just were so stunning. I'm like, I have to have that. But it does take a couple of years before they bloom when you first plant them. You know, what does it say? The first year they sleep, the second year
they creep.
And the third year they leap, right?
That's right. That's right. I think the climbing hydrangeas are sometimes notoriously slow to bloom. And the first couple of years, I think they sleep more than just that first year.
Yeah.
They're slow to take off. But once they get to be about 4 or 5 years old, then they really do take off. And they're wonderful plants. But I would strongly advise, and I'm speaking from experience, not to plant them against your house.
Right. Yeah.
I put mine against my chimney, and it was gorgeous, and I loved it, and it bloomed east side of the house, so morning sun, afternoon shade, and then it reached the roof, and that's when it had to come down.
Yeah.
So, And plant it in the correct place.
I was saying, and it doesn't hurt the trees. I should mention that people might be reluctant to have it climb up an oak tree, but it does not hurt the oak tree.
It does not. There are two types of vines. One where the growth circles around a support, be it a tree or a trellis or whatnot. And that type of vine should not be placed against living structures because it will girdle them, literally. Climbing hydrangeas grow with what we call holdfasts. They don't entwine themselves around the support or the stem. They have these little rootlets that come out, and rootlets is not the right name, but they're holdfast, and they hold on to the bark. So they do no damage when they're climbing up a tree. If anyone ever went down to Alan Haskell's nursery in New Bedford years ago when Alan was still alive, he had the most fantastic climbing hydrangea growing up. I don't know if it was an oak or what it was, but it was a giant tree, and it went out along the limbs, and when it was in bloom, it was spectacular.
Wow. Yeah.
And it didn't hurt the tree at all.
Yeah. So maybe Catherine should take a look at how much the tree is shading that hydrangea. Maybe pruning up that oak tree or that she has it on might help to give it a little more sun, you think?
I think so. Maybe could be, you know, you might have to have an arborist do
it.
But if you could selectively open up the crown to allow more sunlight in, I think that the vine would do better.
Yeah, maybe, Catherine, you'll get more blooms, too, if you get a little more sun.
Yes.
All right. So lots that we can plant right now. We talked a little bit about it's cooler today. Probably the only thing I've really held off on is my basil. I haven't put basil out yet. Have you?
No, I have not.
Yeah, it's a little cool for basil.
That was going to be something that I suggested you do hold off on, particularly until this Northeaster goes through.
Right.
A year ago, maybe two, I invested in a little plastic greenhouse from Joblot. It's not their smaller one. It's actually 4x4, and it's like Tinker Toys when you put it together and has a plastic covering. And I bring it up and set it up on my deck in April, and I start moving things into it from my basement just so I can get them out of my basement, mm-hmm. but also to get a head start, my cannas and things like that. And so I also use it for a holding place for things like basil and other plants that I really do not want to push the envelope on them. Mm-hmm. I want to keep them happy until I get them into the ground. So I am holding off on basil. I also have some annuals that I'm not ready to plant yet, so they're also in this little job lot greenhouse.
Yeah, and, you know, I normally buy a basil plant. I actually started from seed for the first time ever. So those are still inside. They're looking good now.
Yeah.
So I really want them to have a success getting out there. And for some of the annuals, folks, if they're looking at annuals in, I would say, the garden centers, not so much the big box stores, if they're outside at the garden centers, they're fine to put outside. But if they're in a greenhouse or in
right.
some sheltered area, we're going to want to maybe harden them off.
You want to harden them off. I want to say one thing before we leave basil.
Yeah.
You know, we've had a real problem with downy mildew of basil for the past, I'm going to say, at least five mm-hmm. years. And what I try to encourage people to do is look for the varieties that are resistant to downy mildew. The plant breeders really got to work on that problem because basil is a, you know, a very popular plant.
Yeah.
And we don't want it dying in July and August. So if people what people should look for is Prospera Compact. That's a variety of basil. It is showing up at most of the local garden centers, along with all the other basils,
mm-hmm.
But the Prospera Compact is resistant to downy mildew. Another good one is a Rutgers Obsession. It's a wonderful basil. When everything else, all your other basil succumbs, this is still going strong in September and October. So if you're a real basil lover and you have been disappointed in recent years by losing them to downy mildew, look for those two particular resistant varieties.
I'm going to add those to my list, too. All right, so hardening off, and this probably goes for the plants that we want to bring outdoors as well. So talk a little bit about that process.
Well, hardening off, if you've had things, bought things from a greenhouse, or you've had been growing indoors under lights, or you have your houseplants that have been indoors, the conditions you're going to move them in are pretty radically different from what they've had in a greenhouse or your house, where they've had a relatively steady temperature, they're not subject to really strong direct sunlight, and you've been watering them properly. We hope. Sometimes I don't. So you need to gradually harden them off. That's the term that's used to the outdoor conditions. And it's fairly simple. On nice days, you can put them outside in a, say, dappled sunlight type of area and keep them protected from strong wind and bring them in at night or put them in a sheltered area at night where they're covered and not necessarily subject to fairly chilly temperatures. And it takes about a week, it's not very long, of doing this, gradually giving them more and more direct sunlight. And eventually you can just leave them out all the time and plant them right in the ground. It just conditions plants to the outdoor conditions, and it takes about a week.
Yeah, and they can get sunburned, right? You see leaves.
Sure
yeah,
can.
Even the ones that take full sun, if you just all of a sudden put them right out there, they.
Oh,
yeah.
I think one of my earliest experiences, this is back in the early 70s, maybe even the late 60s, in my enthusiasm on a beautiful April day, I put all of my houseplants outside into a bright, sunny area and went off and did grocery shopping and came home, and they all literally had sunburn, and I lost most of them. So lesson learned.
We're talking gardening this morning. If you have a question or a tip for us, 866-999-4626. That's 866-999-4626. Our email address is thepoint@capeandislands.org, and we'll talk more after a quick break. You're listening to The Point. It's Gardening This Morning with horticulturist and entomologist Roberta Clark. 866-999-4626 is our number. That's 866-999-4626. Our email address, thepoint@capeandislands.org. Phyllis is giving us a call from Wellfleet. Hi, Phyllis.
Hi there. Should I shut my radio off?
Yeah, that'd be a great idea if you could do that. Yeah, so we don't hear the sunny feedback. Yeah, go ahead.
Okay, I'm trying to shut my radio off. One second. So I have three fig trees. I can't remember all of the varieties. One is a brown turkey, one is a celeste, and one is something else. Two of them are doing very well, but a huge one, I thought I was supposed to cut it way back. I think I might have chopped off too much. Oh. And I'm wondering, there seem to be some leaves coming out near the ground and some new growth, but there are some leaves that look pretty dead and they're pretty long. And I'm wondering, should a big tree that tends to reach way out be encouraged to grow? Like, should I cut out the middle branches and let it grow out, or should I cut out the outer branches and try to encourage growth from the middle?
I will be honest with you. I've never pruned my fig. So it's I have a variety called, it's Olympia. I remembered that. And it is a hardy fig. I have it in a large pot, and it lives over the winter tucked up against the outside of the chimney. And it's getting quite tall, and it has a lot, actually has a lot of figs on it right now, but it also has a lot of smaller sort of skinny branches coming out of the bottom area. I'm actually going to cut several of those off. They have leaves but no fruit, and I'd like to encourage the rest of the plant to be a bit stronger. So I think I would maybe selectively prune this. If you have anything that's obviously dead, do the old rule of thumb scratch test. You know, scratch it and see if it's green under the bark. If it's not, prune it out.
Yeah,
that would be my recommendation.
Right. Okay, and so one is just one tall stalk with some leaves near the top, and one is low to the ground and spreading out. There are three different varieties.
Yeah.
Does it usually take a couple of years for them to produce fruit? Because I've only had them for two of them for 2 years and one for three.
My experience is it does take several years before they're reliably produce fruit. Mine is 3 years old, and this is the first time I see that it is actually setting fruit. Mm-hmm. All of the varieties have slightly different growth habits. Mine, as I described it, has a lot of, it's tall as a main central stem that gets fairly tall, but it has a lot of skinnier stems coming off towards the bottom. I think where what I would like to see is just having a nicely branched, so I might pinch off the top growth. I wouldn't prune it back, just pinch off the top growth, and that's going to encourage side branches to form, while I'm going to take off the skinny, non-productive branches at the base.
Right.
And what do you do to protect it during the winter?
I don't do anything. This is a particularly hardy variety, so I don't have to bring it in. It sits in my driveway during the growing season where it gets full sun, but in the winter I pull it up against the house, so it's tucked but sort of between the wall of the house and where the chimney juts out. So it's in a sheltered location, but it is subject to ambient temperature.
Phyllis, are your trees in pots or are they in the ground?
No, they're all three are in the ground, and they're in three different places in my garden.
Ah, yeah.
And your brown turkey is living well.
I wish that, I could remember.
It surprises me because brown turkey can be hardy. I remember Jenny's big tree in Woods Hole. I think you remember that.
Oh, yeah. She, matter of fact, she's just giving me the thumbs up, so hers is doing well.
Yep. Yeah. But in more open areas, Woods Hole is sort of unique in that it's pretty much water, surrounded by water on three sides, so it's a milder growing condition. More inland, I know C.L. Fornari has a giant brown turkey. She has it in a giant pot that sits on a little platform with rollers underneath it. So it rolls into her garage for the winter. So brown turkey, you've got it in the ground, and it sounds like it's doing great.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. All right, Phyllis, okay. hopefully that's helpful.
Much.
Yeah, you bet. 866-999-4626 is our number. That's 866-999-4626. Our email address is thepoint@capeandislands.org. I haven't really noticed a lot of winter moth this spring, but I'm sure they're around, right? Have you noticed any? Are they fewer, or is it just because I took down my apple trees?
I don't think you're imagining it. I, for the past several years, we have some, but we're not in outbreak proportions. Dr. Elkington from UMass, as part of his research in managing winter moth, did release a parasitic fly in several locations here on the Cape. And as with most biological control, it takes a number of years before the populations of the parasitic flies build up. So it takes several years for them to actually have some effective management of the pest species, and I think that's kicked in.
Yeah.
He released the flies in the early part of the 2000s, and for the past, I'm going to say, 5 years, the number of winter moths I've seen are very few.
Fewer, yeah. What about the gypsy moth? Does that same fly work for them or no?
No, this fly is specific for winter moth. Gypsy moth has their own cohort of parasites and predators, and there is a tachinid fly that gets into the gypsy moth population. What makes the gypsy moth population fall and stay low is a fungus in the environment, Entomophaga. And when we have wet springs, when the caterpillars are out and feeding, this fungus sets in and causes the population to basically die. Not all of them. There are always enough that survive. So we have small populations on a yearly basis, but not in outbreak proportions.
All right. Let's talk to Carol, giving us a call from Falmouth. Hi, Carol.
Hi there.
Hi.
I am the perpetual container gardener.
And, nothing wrong with that.
And it's so glorious because I'm a good checkbook gardener. You know, it makes my deck so pretty. But last fall, I planted some bulbs in some of the containers, and I understand that the tulips the tulip bulbs need to stay there until the foliage dies back. What about Chionodoxa? It was so pretty when it was blooming, but now these wispy, shreddy, annoying bits of stuff remain all over the place. And I love them. I want them to come back. I don't mind digging them up, but I can't squeeze more flowers in yet.
This is the thing about bulbs. The way they replenish themselves is through photosynthesis, which, of course, takes place in the foliage. So in order to have your bulbs mature properly and prepare flower buds for next year, you have to leave the foliage until it turns yellow. Once it's yellow, you can remove it. It never looks lovely, but it's true for tulips and daffodils and the minor bulbs like Chionodoxa as well. That's one of my favorite little bulbs. It's such a beautiful flower.
Could you lift it out, though, Roberta, like maybe with the dirt and all, and put them in another container somewhere else?
I suppose you could do that, but you want to let them, wherever they are, you want to let them, the foliage mature until it turns yellow.
All right.
Okay. They seem to have little bulbs on the ends of their, where there had been flower. There's quite a little knob there. Is that important?
They might be multiplying. Mm-hmm. If I understand your description correctly, you know, you plant one bulb and all the growing conditions are lovely and they flower and the foliage is allowed to mature, the bulb itself will multiply. Where you once had one bulb, you'll now have two or three bulbs. So that might be what that is.
Carol, thanks for the call. You know, Carol mentioned she can't squeeze anything else in, and she reminded me I have a couple of container pots that I have in my front yard, and I put some violas and pansies in there, and they have done so well and look so fabulous. They're just sort of bursting over the edges of the pot that I have the flowers that I bought for the rest of the season just kind of waiting because I just don't have heart to pull up those beautiful, I love the violas, right? And they just look so great. I'm like, I just can't pull them out.
They look great longer than we think they should. So yeah. We're ready to put our summer bloomers in, but the violas still look lovely. I solved that problem for myself this year by actually putting them into the ground.
Yeah.
And they looked beautiful until the rabbits ate all the blossoms.
Oh, dear. Yeah, those darn rabbits. All right. Tor's giving us a call. Good morning, Tor.
Joe, good morning, Mindy, and it's a delight to be able to bring an observation to you regarding figs.
Okay.
I was listening to your description of figs, and I'm right now looking at an Audubon print, the artist, ornithologist, who shows that widderbirds, a European variety of figs, primarily are food source for the widders. However, my question to you is, about reproduction and pollination. And I'm looking at remarks on Google that tell me that parthenogenesis plays heavily into the common fig without needing the pollination of the wasp that is key for pollinating other forms like brown turkey, Celeste, Brunswick, and Mission. However, parthenogenesis means selfing, that our fig, what is commonly growing around the foundation of Orleans Middle School out in the environment, is actually selfing through parthenogenesis. I think that's a fascinating topic for discussion.
All right, Tor, thanks for that. Roberta, you have any thoughts?
If I can say it properly this morning, parthenogenesis, that's my tongue is not working right, he is absolutely correct. It's basically a form of self-fertilization, self-pollinization, and it occurs in many species of plants. So it wouldn't surprise me if it happens in some figs as well.
Mm-hmm. Lois writes, she's wondering if there's any hope for her forest pansy eastern redbud. She got it at a garden center, planted it in April 2021. She says it's deteriorated over the past few years, and now only about a third of the tree has blossoms and or leaves. Would it help to prune off the unproductive branches even though they're not dead?
My experience with forest pansy the problem I had with forest pansy was I planted it in the wrong location and it was subject to strong winds and just there was a lot of breakage. But I planted another redbud in a much better location and it looked gorgeous for a number of years. And then slowly, one by one, the limbs started dying back until only part of it was living, which is what hers sounds like.
Yep.
And the problem was it contracted verticillium wilt. Mm. And verticillium is a fungus that lives in the soil. It attacks a wide range of different plants and vegetables. Mm-hmm. And that's what happened to my redbud. And one of the indications, besides the slowly dying of different limbs, was if you do sort of a long diagonal cut on a branch, you'll see the vascular tissue, that water conducting tissue, is discolored. Verticillium grows in the vascular system of plants and causes certain areas of the plant that's fed by those particular vascular tissues to slowly wilt and die. So she might do that cut to see if there's discoloration in the vascular system. She could take some samples to the Master Gardener Clinic at the Cooperative Extension and have the Master Gardeners or Russ Norton, the Cooperative Extension agent, take a look at them. But I suspect she might have verticillium wilt. And unfortunately, there is no cure for that.
Oh, that's unfortunate. So you might have to just replace the whole tree then, if that's the case, right?
Correct.
Now, if she were to replace the whole tree, what does it live in the soil? Would you have to replace some of that soil? What would you have to do to make sure that what you plant there next doesn't?
I wouldn't plant another redbud there.
Oh, you have to plant something that's...
That doesn't get it, yeah.
Oh.
It's like for tomatoes... If you've had, I have seven raised beds, and one of the raised beds, which coincidentally is near to where that red bud was planted, I do get verticillium wilt in my tomatoes. So I have to, when I'm putting tomatoes in that bed, I rotate my tomatoes throughout my garden. I make sure that I'm only putting varieties that are resistant to verticillium in that area. And people can tell by looking, read the tags, or go online, Google the variety. It will have a V or VF. F indicates it's also fusarium resistant. VFT, it's also resistant to tobacco mosaic virus. So the information will be provided on, should be provided on the tag that accompanies the variety.
And also, our local garden centers are very knowledgeable. And if it gets confusing, you can just ask them, right?
Yes,
ask them
for
advice. They'll steer you in the right direction.
Yeah, but for tomatoes, most of the wonderful heirlooms that we love to grow are not disease resistant at all. It's only the more modern hybrids that have had disease resistance bred into them. So if you've had issues with disease problems, particularly the wilt variety, wilt diseases, then make sure you're doing resistant varieties. People have a lot of problem with early blight, which there's not a lot of resistance in tomato varieties to that. But Mountain Magic is probably the most early blight resistant tomato on the market. So if you really don't want to struggle with early blight of tomatoes, plant Mountain Magic.
Yeah, and there are so many different varieties of tomatoes. Sometimes it can just be overwhelming trying to figure out what you want to plant.
It can get confusing because, yes, there are. I've tried to cut back. I'm down to 19 tomatoes this year. Last year I had 24, and the year before that I had 38. I mean,
oh my goodness.
How many tomatoes does one woman need?
Right.
In my case, apparently it's 19 this year.
I have three.
I do research the varieties. I do have heirlooms. I try. Another thing about tomato diseases, air circulation is so important. And I had a customer come into the garden center the other day where I work, and she was new to gardening, and she had a beautiful raised bed, the kind that's off the ground, so you could stand up and garden. I should look into those. And it was 4 feet long, and she wanted to put about four or five tomatoes in there.
That's
just
a lot.
Too much.
Yeah.
Tomatoes, a minimum spacing for tomatoes is 24 inches, and that's pushing it. I also recommend if people are growing indeterminate varieties that they take off the suckers.
Mm-hmm.
You want to allow the possibility for air to circulate and keep the foliage dry if you want to minimize foliar diseases.
Right. Sounds good. All right. 866-999-4626 is our number. That's 866-999-4626. Our email address is thepoint@capeandislands.org. We'll have more after a break. You're listening to The Point. It's Gardening This Morning with horticulturist Roberta Clark. 866-999-4626 is our number. That's 866-999-4626. Our email address, thepoint@capeandislands.org. we're starting to see the emergence of those 17-year cicadas.
I'm very excited about it.
A lot of people are, but I think also people are going, oh, my God, what do I need to do to protect my garden from damage? Nothing, right?
Nothing.
Yeah.
Unless you have, you know, like young apple trees, and then you might temporarily net them. It's really such an incredible phenomena where these creatures live underground for 17 years and then come up and have a brief, you know, adult fling and then disappear for another 17 years. It's pretty amazing.
And really, it's just like maybe they lay their eggs on a little branch or tree that might fall to the ground and then... So it's minimal damage, right?
That's exactly what happens. They are in the process of emerging now. When I was raking out in the front yard, as I'm raking up the leaves, I am finding these fairly perfectly formed round holes, maybe half to three-quarters of an inch in diameter, which is something the nymph stage makes in preparation for emerging. They begin emerging. It's all a function of soil temperature. Generally, the soil needs to have warmed up to around 64 at a depth of 12 inches. Some areas of the Cape, that has already occurred. I've seen pictures of the adults having emerged in Sandwich. I've seen pictures of them and reports of them emerging in Falmouth. I'm in the Mills. I see lots of holes. I haven't found any adults yet, so I think my soils are still a little too cool for them to come out. But yeah, They'll be here soon.
Pretty soon, yeah. We'll have our hot spots where we can, you know, definitely hear them.
Yes, absolutely. They come out and climb up a tree. The nymphal skin splits along the back, and the adult emerges, and it takes a day or so for its full coloration to develop. The noise you hear is made by stridulating organ in the abdomen of the cicada, and it's obviously a mating call. It can be quite loud. You know, some people find it very annoying. It can be.
Yeah.
I don't want to take away from that, but I personally find it a kind of fun.
Yeah, it's only every 17 years,
and it only lasts for maybe a month.
Yeah, right.
So we can tolerate.
We can tolerate that.
The female after mating takes her ovipositor and makes a slit in a very thin, usually new growth of a tree, and will lay her eggs in that. And of course, that end of the branch then will break off and fall to the ground. The eggs hatch, and the teeny tiny little nymphal stage will burrow down in the ground, never to be seen again until 17 years later.
17 years later, yeah. All right, Nancy's got a question about sensory gardens. She said, I am blind and have a variety of different sizes of containers for plants. I also have some railing planters. A few years ago, someone came in and did a gorgeous sensory garden, but it's no longer available. I think when people hear sensory, they think fragrance. What plants would be suitable for a sensory garden using containers? And thank you.
Well, there are so many wonderful plants that do have wonderful not only fragrance from flowers, but also fragrance of foliage. And probably my favorite is lemon verbena. Mm. I always have a pot of lemon verbena on my deck. And when I walk by, I rub the foliage, and it's just one of my aromas. So lemon verbena, basil. One of my favorite times at work is you know, when the basil erupts and I unload it from the racks and take it into the greenhouse, and I have this wonderful basil aroma wafting in my face.
That's pretty almost any of the herbs, like rosemary, oregano, yeah. All of those, they all have you just walk by and touch the leaves and it smells fabulous.
Right. Many of the herbs, the scented geraniums, some of the miniature roses you could grow in a container, and they are also fragrant. surprisingly, right now, one of my snake plants is in bloom. It's an indoor house plant. I have it upstairs in my bedroom, and when I went to bed last night, I had shut the window earlier in the day because it cooled off significantly. And I'm going, what is this I smell in my bedroom? Boy, that's really kind of nice. And then I looked over and I saw my snake plant was in bloom. Yeah. I said, oh, that's it.
Yeah, I guess it almost would be, what flowers and fragrance you like, and maybe staggering some so that you have something, you know, in bloom smelling, you know, throughout the season. I would think at a garden center, they'd be able to help you figure out what some of those might be.
I think so, yeah, absolutely. Yeah. And the good thing about a garden center is you can, find out for yourself by feeling the foliage sniffing your hands.
Yep. All right. Marianne says, we have an old Korean viburnum in our yard that has beautiful, fragrant blooms, but two of the old main stems have developed a rot that peels the bark and makes the stem brown and pulpy. Is there any treatment to prevent spread to the remaining stems or other plants?
Prune it off.
Mm-hmm.
That's probably the best thing. In terms of prevention, no, I don't think so.
Yeah.
Just what it sounds like there's some sort of canker, fungal rot has set in, and it needs to be pruned well into healthy tissue to get the bad tissue away.
All right. Somebody's writing about tomato. Carl is writing about tomatoes. This year, I moved my tomato seedlings into bigger pots early on. I did see even very small plants had very long roots in a few days. So after a few days in 16-ounce solo cups, I moved them into 3-gallon 10-inch pots with a good soil mix. They are actually wider than tall and have large leaves and a thickening stem, not tall and leggy. Wind control lately is a struggle, but I have old garage door panels to protect the garden with. I have 10 cobra beans in solo cup sprouted in 5 days. Carl,
wow.
Carl's the one who sent us those cobra beans. And I just planted my cobra beans, I think, on Sunday.
How fabulous.
I know. I love that. Carl, thank you for sharing that with us, by the way, because that was fabulous. I did another little experiment because, I'm always impatient for my dahlias to bloom. And I had read on, I think, one of the gardening Facebook pages that somebody puts their on April 20th, they put their bulbs in every year and have good luck. So I thought, you know what?
In the ground.
I didn't do it April 20th, but I did do it. I think it was very end of April, beginning of May. And I've been looking, and most of them I am seeing green come up.
Excellent.
I know. Maybe it's just lucky, but we'll see what happens. I'm still watching the ones where I don't see. And you know, we got a puppy in November, and he has a habit he's any of the ones I had from last year that still have that little stem sticking up. He thinks it's a stick and pulls them up. I keep finding my dahlias in the middle of the lawn and I have to replant them again. So I'm not sure if those are going to make it or not, but we'll see.
Yes, well, he's a puppy.
Yeah. All right. A listener wonders about the milkweed that gets cicada eggs deposited in the stems and darkens. Will it survive?
I don't think that cicadas will lay their eggs on a milkweed. They generally go for taller woody plants.
Mm-hmm. All right. And then here's another question. Rabbits eat a lot of my plants. I bought a critter repellent, but the awful garlicky smell is ruining our enjoyment of the garden. Anyone know of a product that works? Perhaps hot pepper paste?
I think rabbits are repelled both by taste and, but mostly by scent. And the repellent that I found most effective is liquid plant skid.
Mm-hmm.
And I just sprayed some the other day, and I did not notice an offensive odor. It's a blood-based product. Rabbits are vegetarians and don't eat meat, so they don't like blood. But it also, to them, apparently smells offensive. I have had people tell me it smells bad, but I used it and was expecting it to smell bad, and it didn't. So perhaps the liquid plant skid might be something to use. I don't want to use it on my vegetables, but when I plant my zinnias and I planted some tall Nicotiana, I sprayed them, and so far, so good.
Mm. So as we mentioned at the beginning of the program, we've got this nor'easter coming in on Thursday. And really the big concern there is the wind.
Yes.
And, you know, I'm just thinking, I have a lot of very tall lilies that are coming up. And there's no way I could, you know, stake them all. So I just guess you have to keep my fingers crossed, I guess. There's not really a lot I can do.
Sometimes gardening is the luck of the draw. you know, we hope to avoid certain things, but don't necessarily win in that regard. My tomatoes are fairly good sized, and they're in their cages already. I find it just easier to put the cages up as soon as I plant the tomatoes.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm hoping they're going to be fine. The wind is supposed to come out of the northeast. They're on the west side of my house. There are some other vegetation a ways from the garden, but that could act as a windshield. Mm-hmm. I have no control over it.
Right. What are you going to do? I've already noticed a couple of my taller lilies have been snapped off by that puppy running through the garden. So I have a feeling I'm not going to have all the lilies that I usually have anyway, yeah, with or without the wind. I also wanted to mention, I was over at Heritage Museum and Gardens at end of last week, and, you know, their rhododendron festival is in full swing.
Yeah.
And it is worth a walkthrough just for all the azaleas and different species of rhododendron they have are just absolutely gorgeous right now. And for those who haven't been out there in a while, you know, they've redone that whole welcome center. And I walked up and went, where am I? It is absolutely gorgeous. And they have, I don't know if it's part of the welcome center there, but they have sort of a window that frames that flume with the waterfall.
Nice.
It is just spectacular.
Yeah. I haven't been in a couple of years, but it's always a worthwhile visit. There are so many interesting plants, even when the rhododendrons aren't in bloom,
right,
but the rhododendrons are clearly spectacular. But it's just a wonderful place to visit, and it's here on the Cape, and, you know, an easy drive for anyone from anywhere on the Cape. And the people should definitely take advantage of it.
Yeah. I also noticed one other thing in my garden. I have allium, and I noticed a couple of them sort of broken, not all the way off, but sort of bent down at the top. Is that happening from a critter, or is that just the wind, or what do you think?
You know, curious you should say that. There have been a number of posts on the Cape Cod Gardening page over the past couple of days that show people with alliums, and they'll have like four or five alliums, and one about mm-hmm. two-thirds of the way up, the stem is like bent, and the flower just hangs down.
Yeah.
Without looking at it more closely, I'd have a hard time saying that it's an insect.
Yeah.
Could be wind. Yeah. We've had a number of gusty days, but I actually just don't know what's doing that.
Yeah, me either.
Yeah.
I mean, I know what the tulips and things, it's the squirrels, because, you know, yes, you catch them in the act, but yeah.
So like onions.
Yeah, so just, we've got about a minute or so left, so some advice for folks. They can put up most things now, right? Seeds and
You know, the rule of thumb has always been Memorial Day, mm-hmm. which is early this year. It's next Monday, which is what, the 26th. I think pretty much anything after this storm can go out and will be fine. I've already started taking houseplants out. They're going into the job lot greenhouse, but some, because the greenhouse is now pretty full, they're going outside in the shade. I've decided I'm purging a number of houseplants if they're not making me terribly happy anymore, mm-hmm. unfortunately, due to my own neglect over the winter. Then they're going to go somewhere else. But yes, you can start doing that now. Pretty much anything can go outside.
Yeah, yeah. I'm actually
after the storm.
I almost brought my houseplants out this weekend, and I didn't. I'm going to wait until after Thursday and start to bring them out at that point. All right, Roberta Clark joins us the third Tuesday of each month through the gardening season. As always, Roberta, thanks for your helpful advice. We always appreciate that.
My pleasure.
I'm Mindy Todd. Thanks for listening.
The Point is produced by Amy Vince. The executive producer is Mindy Todd. Production assistance from Jenny Junker and Dan Tridle. Theme music by Benjamin Verdery and William Coulter.